the expression from the music inspired me so much to take risks, and it inspired damn near the whole rap game.
Hello again, I'm Adam Ons. You may know me as the host of The Opus, and now I'm bringing my own show, The Spark Parade, to the Consequence Podcast Network. I speak with artists and creatives about the cultural artifacts that spark their personal interest and creativity, whether it's music, books, movies, video games, or any other kind of art.
I've never spoke about it in this amount of detail. I'm suddenly going, oh my God, I'm blowing my own mind here, Christ. It's actually a giant part of my life.
By talking about the things we love, we share and discover insights into our personality and the things that drive us.
It's just magic, really. I mean, frustrating. And it makes some people angry, but I don't think anyone's ever done anything like it.
I speak with people like Connor Roberts, Phoenix's Thomas Mars, Chris Gethard, Helen Hong, Adrian Young, and more, so their sparks of inspiration can start a fire in you.
I'm grateful for those who continue to put our history and who we are as a people in the forefront and make you see it.
Find the Spark Parade wherever you get your podcasts.
Before forming Austin-based metal band The Sword, guitarist Kyle Shutt played in a ska band. Not only that, but he was such a fan of Blue Meanies that he joined their street team, and one time he drove across a few states to see them play. The Sword were a successful band, but in late October 2022, The Sword broke up after nearly two decades together. This is Kyle's first interview since their breakup, because he wanted to talk about ska. Let's hope that this signifies a new upbeat project for Kyle.
Do you ever play Guitar Hero, Aaron?
I played it just a little bit.
I played a lot of Guitar Hero at one point in my life. And one of the songs that I really liked to play was Freya by The Sword.
Uh-huh.
Between that and Aaron Nagle playing The Sword for me, I was super into that band.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea, looking at those long-haired Heshers up on stage, that any of them would like ska.
Yes, well, ska roots, they do find their way into unlikely places.
Ska roots, everybody has them. You just got to dig deep enough. That's why we're here.
You were good at Guitar Hero?
I was okay. I wasn't that great.
How similar is Guitar Hero to playing a guitar?
So here's the thing. Like, there's, I feel like Guitar Hero for certain types of music is actually more difficult than playing guitar. Like, legitimately. Like, White Zombie, the Thunderkiss 69 or whatever that song's called. That song is harder to play on Guitar Hero than it is to play on guitar.
But The Sword? How hard is that one?
I can't even remember. I just love that song.
All righty. Well, let's talk to Kyle now.
All right.
So the Sword broke up like October 20th, right?
I guess. I haven't really been keeping track, but very, very, very recently, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so it's November 4th, the day we're recording. So my first question for you is this your first interview since the band broke up?
Yes, it is, technically. I also run a podcast called The Highway, which I have been reticent to roll out another episode of, because I know everybody's probably wants my opinion on the whole thing, but it fucking sucks, and I just have to figure out my life. I've been just burying myself in work, which is usually how I deal with stress.
This is just like to put a message out there to all you non-ska bands: if your band breaks up, let's just come here. Just come here and talk about ska with us,
yeah,
for a while.
Yeah, you can just come to talk about ska.
Yeah. I love waking up early in the morning. Talk about ska.
Yeah. You posted this photo on Twitter with you at, I think it was the Blue Meanies post-wave release show. Is that what that photo is?
It may have been the release show. I don't know exactly what the occasion was. But yeah, if you want the quick version of the story, is that a friend of mine, Ben Hobrach, who we were roommates when I first moved to Austin, in the early days of the internet, we would just, you know, kind of hang out on message boards and stuff. And we heard that one of our favorite bands, Blue Meanies, were playing a free show in Chicago in the alley behind a store called The Alley. And it was Burning Airlines and Blue Meanies. And so, yeah, we, I think, spent like $35 and got some Greyhound tickets and took the 24-hour trip up to Chicago. And made it to the show. It was a real Wayne's World kind of moment for us.
Who is it that's the photo with you?
That would have been Jimmy and the bass player. I'm spacing on his name right now.
Now, I think you had said something before about you were part of their street team.
Yeah. If anybody out there remembers what a street team is, basically you would write to a band and you would just, they would send you, or their label would send you boxes of like promo CDs of like the latest single or show flyers or just anything like that to promote the tours. And it would be your job to run around the town and put those posters and or CDs or stickers or whatever up all over like local, you know, coffee shops, record stores, things like that. Tons of bands did it. Whenever Blue Meanies signed to, I think it was Capitol that the post wave came on, Capitol ended up sending me tons of promo stuff and everything. And in exchange, you would be put on their guest list. And to a 17-year-old kid, that really means a lot. So that was
yeah.
I didn't do it for too many bands, but some of the Asian Man bands, they sent me some stuff. Yeah, it was fun back in the day because I worked at a photocopy center too, so I could copy as many flyers and things as I needed to.
Yeah, those little hookups at those early jobs always end up paying off.
Mm-hmm. What, do you remember what Asian Man bands you did this for?
Oof, this is a long time ago. Probably like ME330. And ooh, it was a long time ago. Maybe Lawrence Arms. They're not really ska, but I'd love that band.
I mean, ska roots.
Yeah. 100%.
Okay, so you're living in Austin. You're on the street team. You get sent these flyers. What's your participation as a street team member?
Back in the day, I would get on the city bus or hop on my bike and go down to Waterloo Records. Record stores, maybe some of them still do. They used to have like a big table out or like a community board or something like that. And you could just like drop your band stickers or promo CDs or just put the show flyers up, things like that. Plenty of like, you know, telephone poles downtown that we would, you know, staple flyers to and stuff like that. Just, you know, vandalism in the name of promoting your favorite band.
So how much would it be like a full day's worth of going to different spots, or was it just a one or two record stores and that was it? You're done.
No, I mean, like Austin was like a live music town. So there was tons of clubs to go around and put posters up at. There was Emo's all up and down Red River, Room 710, tons of record stores, north and south. It's very, very, or I guess it still is, but even back then it was a really music centric town. So there was, everyone was real supportive about you putting up your, you know, flyers and stuff like that.
Now, when you went to see Blue Meanies in Chicago, how was the show? I don't think we really got into too much detail about the show itself.
Yeah, it was funny. Burning Airlines blew the PA out, so it's like the show kind of stopped halfway through, and then they had to like go get like a new, I think a new PA speaker or something like that. I remember there was like some technical difficulty for sure, and I don't know. Blue Meanies were always one of those, like, they were like a really terrifying band if you saw them like in a dark club, especially after, I think the first time I saw them was like Honor System, Lawrence Arms, so I think it was like a Plea for Peace thing, so and think just, you know, a bunch of kind of more lighthearted bands like Link 80 played and stuff like that. But then the Blue Meanies went on and they're just these mean looking dudes in suits, you know, there's just playing this like terrifying like jazz metal almost. I wouldn't even really call them a ska band necessarily.
Yeah, I don't think they would either.
But they're ska core or whatever. I don't know. But they were, I just remember, you know, that being just like really life changing. And then you put a band like that, you know, outside at 3 p.m. You know, and it's just, it wasn't the most terrifying of shows, but I did get to meet them, and that meant a lot. And a weird kind of tangent timeline thing, Burning Airlines, who featured Jay Robbins from Jawbox, he ended up producing the Sword's fourth album and then subsequently mixing like three more records for us after that. So it was kind of fun to hear that story from his angle about what that show was like.
Do you know, did he explain what happened, like why the Sound System blew up? Was it?
No, I don't think. I think it was just like a classic punk rock situation where it was just really haphazard. They had somebody's shitty PA they were borrowing, and then just, yeah, you know, but nothing too out of the ordinary.
Did The Sword ever have any shows like that?
Oh, yeah. So many. Our very first show ever, we played on North Loop in Austin. It's a vintage store now, but it used to be a record store called Sound on Sound. It was in March of 2004. And we were really excited. Everyone, all of us in the band were kind of like well-known within the Austin music scene anyway. So like us forming a new band was kind of a thing people were excited about. So everybody showed up, but the band on before us blew out the PA. So instead of, there was no saving that one. So instead of just not playing, we just played instrumental. And I don't know, I bet it was pretty devastating looking back on it. But yeah, there's been so many shows where there's been egregious technical difficulties, but you just got to power through. You could be an asshole and you could you know, have an ego about it and blah, throw a fit, or you could just rock. It's a lot more cool when you just rock.
Yeah, I mean, I think the cool thing with The Sword is that y'all had great riffs, and so everybody has an instrument. You don't have a singer that's just standalone, mm-hmm. So you could just power through as an instrumental band.
Yeah, and eventually, like toward the end of our career, we could have written an entire instrumental set just from the amount of songs that we had.
Yeah,
no lyrics, but yeah,
totally.
Before you were a professional musician, this trip to Chicago, was that the longest distance you'd ever made to go see a show?
Absolutely, yeah. It probably still is, just to see a show.
Yeah, how many hours is that by bus?
I think it was like 21 hours on the way there and then 24 hours on the way back.
Oh my God.
I mean, it's not that far to Chicago, but you know, Greyhounds, they stop at every podunk little town along the way.
Yeah. You had your friend to sit next to. Do you remember any weirdos on the bus ride?
Not really. Because like if you get off a Greyhound, then you're kind of allowed to get back on before anybody else.
Right.
When it reboards. So we kind of, since we were on it for so long, we kind of had like free range of like whatever seat we wanted. So it was pretty chill.
Nice.
The only time that ever got weird was we stopped in Memphis like after midnight and got off the bus and took a walk or like outside. We're like, nope, never mind. We're good. We're just go back in the station. The Chicago Greyhound station was a fucking scene though. That was that was probably the biggest city that I'd been to by myself at that point, or, you know, like without my parents or whatever. And just seeing what the seeing how the unhoused people get by out there, it was very eye-opening.
Yeah, especially as a kid,
because you're 17, is that?
I was 17.
I remember, and I had a brief period of time in my 20s where I didn't have a car, so that we did a few Greyhound trips out of town. And yeah, like you're saying, you stop a lot, but it's weird because you stop in a lot of weird, like, places you don't even expect, like just towns you never heard of. And like the Greyhound's like in a weird location, like behind the grocery store or something. It can be kind of fun, like if you've never done it before. I'm sure it gets really tiring after a while, though.
I say it's a great motivator for you to save up for a car.
I feel bougie compared to you guys. I was an Amtrak kid. I was always taking Amtrak everywhere.
Oh, I've never ridden the train before. I've always wanted to. Not in the States, at least.
It's nice. Yeah. But you get a similar amount of weirdos and you're kind of stuck with them.
So 17 might seem like a really young age for you to head out of state, but you'd already toured by that point.
Not necessarily, like just like kind of long. When I was 15, I joined this ska band that took me on some like long weekends of playing shows, I would say. Not full on tours, you know, just, you know, 3 or 4 shows in New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma, stuff like that.
What was that band called?
you can't find it anywhere on the internet.
Doesn't matter.
It was, I know, but I've looked, but it was a terrible name, but it's a perfect ska band name. 10 Betty Zane, because you had to have, you know, a number in your band name back in those days. But it's actually, it's a real object. It was a 10 Betty Zane, T-I-N. It's a patent, actually, that's the name of like the Jiffy Pop stovetop popcorn device.
Oh yeah.
The patent of that is the device is called a 10 Betty Zane.
Nice. That's a good ska band name. That's hardly the worst ska band name.
So you grew up in Middleton, Texas, right?
Midland, actually.
Midland. I'm sorry. Midland, Texas. Where's that at? That's West Texas?
Very West Texas. Do you remember, I don't know how old you are, but do you remember Baby Jessica Fell Down the Well?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was me. I did that. No, but that's where that is the town in which that occurred. And it's also where Friday Night Lights took place. And that was a real thing back then. It wasn't just a TV show.
Nice. Well, I mean, you were living there as a kid when the Baby Jessica thing happened?
No, I was a baby, I think, when that was going on.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, we didn't move there until I was about 8.
Okay.
So I think I'd heard you say before, you know, that you didn't really get much in the way of touring music through your town. Like it was a town where Pantera and those kind of bands came through, basically.
Yeah, I did get to see Pantera, which is pretty cool. I thought I was going to die at the show. I was like 14, I think. Saw ZZ Top a couple of times. George Thorogood came through, but it wasn't like, you know, Austin or anything like that, you know, which is only 5 hours away. But and there, you know, Lubbock would get some big shows, which was about an hour and a half away. But I didn't have a car. My parents, you know, I could barely talk them into taking me to go see, you know, the whoever in Odessa, which was only about 20 minutes away. So it was it was rough going back in the day, which is funny, though, because now that I kind of like look back on it all, like the Sword kind of falls halfway in between Pantera and ZZ Top. You mm-hmm. know, of like the spectrum of Texas rock and roll.
So, but you did get 10 Betty Zane came through town.
Yeah, there was like a youth center that a lot of like Christian metal and punk bands would play, and like all the local DIY bands. And so like, you know, the Tooth and Nail scene, they would fucking play anywhere, you know. And that was kind of, I want to say like MXPX came through one time. What was that band? 90 pound
Wuss, yeah.
Or something. Yeah. Yeah. They came through one time. But you just kind of had to go to whatever show you wanted to let your, you know, that there, you know.
What about that band Training for Utopia? Did they ever come through?
Maybe. I don't know.
I mean, they were the one band from that scene that I liked. Uh-huh. Yeah. They were good. Did the teen center have like a, I mean, they always give them like silly names, like the cave or the underground.
No, this was just like it was just called the Midland Center, and it was just like a downtown event thing you could rent out.
Gotcha.
But it was relatively inexpensive.
Did they ever try to do the guided, like the prayer before the show?
No, I don't think so. Maybe. I don't know. Might have been outside smoking cigs.
Nice. So when the Sword was early touring, did you guys ever play any Christian teen centers and have to like navigate the Christian adults?
No, but we did play a very very famous Unitarian church in Philadelphia. Yeah. That we played many times. Every band you've ever heard of has played there.
Yeah, First Unitarian's cool though. They don't pull that thing.
No. No. I can't think of any other churches that we would have played, unless it was, you know, like a what's the word for it? Decommissioned worship center.
Right.
Beautiful old church in like Colchester or something like that you end up playing in the Ukraine.
Right. Yeah. And then it's been turned into just a venue.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So does that mean that 10 Betty Zane was a Christian ska band?
Yes. The guys were, you know what I mean? Oh. The music wasn't necessarily like, God first or whatever, but you know, they were older than me. They were like 20, 21, you know, and good old wholesome boys. And you know, my mom, you know, saw their show. It was basically like I saw them play. I thought their trombone player sucked, and then I saw that they were playing a show in Odessa the next week, and I said, hey, you should give me your tape and I'll go home and learn all your songs, and then you should let me play in your band next week. And they were like, all right. You know, okay, why not? So yeah, I went and went home and learned all the, I played trombone, so I like learned all the songs and showed up to the show the next week. My mom was there, met the band, we played the show, went off great. And then I was just in the band. And then I kind of ruined that band for them because eventually the trombone player just quit. And then it was just me and the trumpet player as the horn section. And then I started writing songs on guitar for the band. Like I wrote like two new songs. And so I would show the guitar players how to play the songs. And then I think they were like, why is this 15-year-old kid like writing my guitar parts now? You know, and there's so one of the guitar players quit. And so we went from like a 9-piece to a 7-piece real fast. And we tried to get on like festivals or things like that, you know, but just it just didn't work. Like all the gigs we played were super DIY. And they didn't know what they were doing. And I was just happy to be in a van, like driving around, you know, in a band. So it was fine. I think my parents were probably happy to have me out of the house for the weekends just because I was a bit of a disobedient turd. But, you know.
Was the band based out of, where was the band based out of?
They were from Hobbs, New Mexico, and that's not that far from Midland. It was probably like, I don't know, like a 2-hour drive or something like that. My dad would drive me to the state line and the band would pick me up and we would rehearse some weekends, unless we had like gigs, in which case we would hit the road.
Okay, can you remember any of the songs? Like, can you throw some song titles at us?
I really can't, honestly. Like, I know I have the CD. I never played on their record. And I do have a CD of that band somewhere, but I genuinely do not remember any of that shit. I bet if I heard it, it would be like, probably like one of those, what is it? This Is Your Life. You know, like... I was trying to think of their names too, like the band members' names. Like I remember Joby was the bass player. We had a girl drummer, Sherry. She was awesome. Michael was the singer. I think Waylon was the trumpet player. And then Cody was the guitar player. Is that it? Is there any more? I don't remember. I think that's it. So I guess it was a 6-piece by the time we were done. And yeah, the band just kind of fizzled out. I don't know what happened. I think I quit. Actually, I think I got a girlfriend and was like, you know what? I think I like Converge. You guys, I'm going to like stop playing trombone in a ska band.
We'll be right back after this.
What's your trombone history? Were you in the school band?
Yeah, that's how it started. I wanted to be on the drum line, but for whatever reason, I got talked into playing the trombone. I don't even really remember. And I remember like signing up for it, but then like the week before school started, I was like, what the hell did I sign up for? Why am I playing trombone? This is so weird. But it turns out I was very good at it. And I don't know. Music just makes sense to me, you know? So I'm really good at playing by ear. And so that's kind of like where, like I would learn the bare minimum of like how to read the music. And then I would just memorize it all and just play it, you know, like not really like paying attention to the sheet music necessarily, which still happens. I'm very bad at reading music, but that's fine. I just, you know, it's not cool, man. I just want to rock. I don't want to read.
Now, one time you opened for Zebrahead in Lubbock, Texas.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure it was Zebrahead and Lit. Before like they were, had a song or anything. I think it was like 98, maybe 97, 98.
What do you remember about that show?
It was at a weird coffee house. I'm almost positive it was in Lubbock. And yeah, it was a lot of that was kind of like back in the day when you wanted to play all ages venues. You couldn't like, you know, play the punk club. You played the coffee house. And that might still be a thing. I don't know. But it was so long ago, man. I was 15. I'm 40 now. I might have been 16, but yeah, I loved playing shows. It was just, I don't know. Like I never get stage fright, anything like that. You know, I was born to fucking hop up there and do my thing. But, I think my favorite band at the time was Real Big Fish, and they had opened for Real Big Fish. So I think I was just really happy to be like 2 degrees away from Real Big Fish. I was like, I'm on the right path. I'm doing something right here.
Yeah.
I thought I read that there was 0 people at the Zebrahead show.
Maybe.
But there wouldn't really be 0 people if there was Zebrahead and Lit there. It'd be all those members.
But besides the members, zero paying customers. Yeah, who cares?
Oh, I could see that. You know, yeah. I mean, there was a big room at the time. I remember, yeah, it just, I don't know, that was a long time ago. I was just happy that there was a show, that I had something to do. Like, Midland was so fucking boring. I would have, like, gladly played to no one.
And when you're 15, 16,
I do remember there being very few people there. I think we wore capes. I think I had, like, made us
capes
out of, like, some weird sheet, you know? Or I don't know. I was really excitable.
I love the idea of a young ska band all wearing capes.
No, it was just me and the trumpet player.
Oh, just the horn section. The rest of the band could fuck off.
Yeah. I think they were specifically like, yeah, we're not doing that.
You guys go ahead, though. Okay, so you moved to Austin. When did you move to Austin?
Yeah, I would go on these little tours or whatever, you know, weekend shows, and come back to high school and be like, wow, y'all, this, like, none of this shit matters. I have to get out of here. There's a whole world out there, you know? And so I dumped my school program down to, like, the remedial level and just got my, took the test and got the hell out of there. And so I moved to Austin 10 days after I turned 17. That would have been in May of 2000.
Okay.
And my parents were very adamant about me going to school, and I was, did not take it seriously at all. I did really poorly in school anyway, so I don't know why. I just was like, yeah, I'll go to school. Yeah, sure. So I signed up for fucking the community college program. And then I think I went to school for like 2 weeks, but then I was living in a co-op, you know, in West Campus area, where like they had like clothing optional hours, you know, and shit like that. So I was like, I'd rather just hang out with naked chicks and smoke weed by the pool and play guitar than go learn French, you know, at a school. So yeah, I went for about 2 weeks before I just kind of, I don't even think I dropped out. I think I just let it ride. And then, so I think my GPA is officially like 0.0, like John Belushi in Animal House. But whatever, man, it's cool. It doesn't matter.
Totally.
Now you were inspired to move to Austin specifically because of the Dead Milkmen?
Kind of. Yeah, in a way. There were twofold. Dead Milkmen had that song, 6 Days, where each, I guess, verse of the song is about, or each line is about a different city that they would tour through and about how much they hated all those cities. But the last line of the song is about when they got to Austin and how great it was and how they wanted to stay and how rent was cheap and everything. I was like, oh, that's cool. You know, Austin, huh? And then also, like I said, I was really into, I listened to everything. I like all kinds of music. But a friend of mine gave me a Converge CD. And through that, I found out about Equal Vision Records. And in the early days of the internet, eventually found Robodog Records, which turned into Robotic Empire. But at the time, they had like all these wild bands like Page 99 and Circle of Dead Children. And this band from Austin called Employer Employee. And I was like, wow, okay, so there's bands in Austin doing this kind of shit. And like, you don't have to be on MTV to tour around in a van. And so it was like kind of all the pieces were coming together in my head. And I was like, I'm moving to Austin. I'm going to just not take no for an answer and just go to every show, meet everybody I can, and just take over the world with my rock and roll. And that was sort of my goal.
What, when you first moved to Austin, what was your favorite venue?
Emos, always.
Hell
yeah. Yeah, the first show I went and saw there was, I think it was Bouncing Souls and Dwarves. It was fucking sick.
And that was on the outside stage, I'm guessing?
Yeah, it wasn't, technically it wasn't outside yet. It was, they hadn't knocked that wall down, so it was a sweat box, man. It was miserable in there, but it was, so like, I didn't really know about Dwarves. I liked them, but I didn't know about their reputation live. Right. And so I wormed my way up to the front row, you know, and it was an all ages venue. And so, but I didn't know that He Who Cannot Be Named would come out naked with nothing but a luchador mask on. And then so I could see every wrinkle in his nutsack, you know. And then like after about 3 songs, once I was just kind of kept getting hit in the face with the dick sweat, and I was like, okay, I'm going to the back. This is okay.
Yeah.
Great show though. It was great. But technically he exposed himself to a minor. But
sure.
Yeah, but whatever. I mean, I didn't care.
I mean, I feel like that was a like late 90s, early 2000s staple, though. Like,
maybe
fucking dudes getting naked at shows, at all ages shows.
Yeah, Propaganda did it a lot. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Does that happen anymore? Is that a thing?
God, I hope not.
I know.
It's like the last thing I wanted to show.
I was going to say, is Propaganda, like, are they enemies of the show because of Ska Sucks? Or
I don't think so. I don't think they're enemies. I mean, I've spoken to Chris before in a message. We've been pleasant. So,
oh, good. They're wonderful people.
Blue Meanies were an important band for you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, every era of it too. I kind of went deep on the eBay kind of rabbit hole and got every single old 7-inch and compilation and CD EP thing, like every little out of print trinket that I could find. I got, and I, because of that too, I got really into like other bands, you know, like Captured by Robots, who have now evolved into this crazy grind metal thing that still plays in Austin sometimes. It's pretty wild. Yeah, everything that all those people did, Bitchy, all their side projects, everything, all of it. Love that band.
Can you recall just when you discovered them? Did you discover them through ska?
No, you know what it was? I think a friend of mine, Drew Williams, he had an older brother who had moved to Austin like 2 or 3 years before the rest of us to go to college. And he got a job at the college radio station, and he would just bring home stacks of CDs of stuff that he thought that we would like. And in one of those stacks was a copy of Kiss Your Ass Goodbye. And it wasn't that one. I really enjoyed some of the songs on that one. That album as a whole didn't necessarily wow me at first, but knowing about them, I went and got a copy. I think I mail ordered a Full Throttle. And that was the one that really like, that was like, wow, this shit is insane. You know, and that from there on, I kind of like got into the rest of the stuff.
Yeah, I think there's an interesting, you talked before about how they got lumped into ska, but they're really more like jazz metal, you know, I think would be close. You'd say would be more of a better description of the band.
Totally. Maybe. I don't know. Yeah, they were just their own thing. There was nobody, you couldn't sound like them without ripping them off.
Yeah.
The Sword, I've read like several interviews where the subject of what your specific subgenre comes up, and it seems to be an odd point of contention both within the scene and with you guys. I'd love to get your take. So the general consensus is that it's like either doom metal or stoner metal. What is your take on that whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, well, it was really important for us early on to not be pigeonholed as like a weed band, because there was a scene of fucking just weed bands, you know, like Bongzilla, Sleep, you know, had Dope Smoker, you know what I mean? It was like none of our songs were about weed. Like that was kind of, to us, it was like, you know, Electric Wizard, Dope Throne, you know what I mean? Like we didn't write songs about drugs. It was, we were this kind of, we weren't like fantasy metal, you know. I mean, I guess you could have, but it was just so much like it was to describe and stuff that we just wanted to be a rock band. Like we played like rocked out metal songs or metaled up rock songs. And so we really didn't, in an attempt to not get pigeonholed, because once people make up their mind about you, there's no changing it. So we tried to squash that early on. So in a weird way, when we first dropped, like people didn't know what to call us. So they called us hipster metal. And like hipster was kind of like a new term at the time. And we're like, what? Like, what the fuck is hipster metal? They're like, you know, people that are like ironically playing this like metal music. You're like, we're like, this ain't ironic, man. This is the baddest shit we've fucking ever heard, man. And like new metal was king at the time too. So like everything had to have a label. People didn't know what to call us. We were like, you know, on MTV and like radio stations with, you know, sounding completely different than everything else that was going on. People just didn't know what to call us. And so many, many terms went around. Doom wasn't even a thing back in those days. Like that wasn't like Doom was reserved for bands like Burning Witch or Candlemass, like real Doom and Gloom bands, you know? And it eventually just sort of like, they started calling us girlfriend metal because we were the one metal band that your girlfriend would like. We got called fucking everything. It was just absurd. And it was just, we're
like
just
boyfriend jeans.
Yeah, exactly. Like we're just a fucking rock band. but people, they have to put you in a box to feel right about it. It used to bother me a little bit more than it does, just because it just, I don't know, it just turned into a joke where it's just like, what are they going to call us this year? You know? And, but you know, Doom, whenever that whole, like, the Doom is a very specific subgenre of,
yeah,
of metal, you know? And
so, you guys don't play slow enough to be Doom.
No, not at all. And so, now that now it's just been co-opted and everything is called Doom. That's why when I started my Pink Floyd heavy metal laser band, Doom Side of the Moon, I called it that because of the Easy Star All-Stars reggae version, Dub Side of the Moon. Mm-hmm, I was like, mm-hmm. Well, I'll just call it fucking Doom Side of the Moon. And it kind of like, the idea of that came from when I was going to do a solo album, which I eventually did. But when I was thinking about it, I was like, at the time, the Sword had put out a record, High Country, that was pretty polarizing. And I was like, thinking about doing a solo album that would really not sound like the Sword, and I was like, man, I got real high one day. I was like, man, nobody wants a fucking like solo album from me. I should just start a Pink Floyd cover band called Doom Side of the Moon, and y'all fucking eat it up. And I was like, well, that's actually a really good idea. And so I got my guitar out, and then I made Doom Side of the Moon. So that's and then by the time I put that record out, it hit number, I think it was 82 on the Billboard Top 200 charts as a completely independent release. And so,
sick.
Doom Side of the Moon is hands down the furthest I've ever taken a joke.
Doom Side of the Moon, I like it. One of the things I like about Doom Side of the Moon is that it, like when you first hear the concept, you assume it's going to be all in on every moment. It's going to be very metal sounding, but that's not how you approach it. You approach each song with kind of what it needs and what it wants and what feels right to the dynamics of the given moment of the song.
I agree. Yeah, it was the way that I kind of put it. Well, I guess number one, like, you can't go fucking around with Pink Floyd. Then you're just messing with people's emotions at that point, and you know, you got to really tread lightly when you want to reimagine something as legendary as that. But I also, you know, I wanted to put my own spin on it, and I noticed that like nobody had ever done like a heavy metal version of it before. Like the Government Mule and like Dream Theater had like covered it, you know, but like that was just a really faithful, you know, recreation. I wanted to really shake it up. So my thought process was like, what if Black Sabbath was the band that wrote and recorded those songs instead of Pink Floyd? So that was kind of where I like did. That was my jumping off point.
Yeah, the atmospheric sounds that you bring in, you really emphasize that in certain songs, which I think is an interesting aspect of both certain subgenres of metal, but also what was the source material. Like the source material had a lot of atmospheric sounds that was part of the album.
Yeah. I don't know if you're familiar with many bands begin the recording process, you'll make like a chart, you know, of like all the songs, like a graph, like, you know, all the song titles, yeah, along up the columns, and then the rows are all like the instruments necessary. And so I specifically wanted there to be a column of just ambience and to think about that for each song. Not that I had to have it, but you know, I wanted to like leave room for that in each of those songs. And yeah, I had a lot of fun creating a lot of my own samples and stuff like that, especially like the when you first play the record, all those sounds that you hear kind of swirling around. There was a metal shop next door, so I took a Zune mic in there and had the metal shop worker like turn on all the machines and use them, and I recorded like every different like weird industrial thing I could get my hands on.
That's rad. Do you know if you play it along with a Wizard of Oz, does it sync up?
It does. It really does, in a weird way, man. Sick. When I was trying to roll out the promo for that, I called up our local weekly paper, the Austin Chronicle, and they assigned one of their music writers to do a little piece on it, and he was like, why don't you just come over to my house and we'll smoke weed and listen to it and try to see if it syncs up with the Wizard of Oz. And I was like, that is a genius idea, let's do it. And man, it syncs up in some of the weirdest fucking ways. It was a little scary, honestly, at times, but it was fun, especially when like when Great Gig in the Sky is going on, when the tornado is going, and then like whenever my guitar solo comes in and out during like the Lollipop Guild doing like weird ballerina dances, it all syncs up like perfectly. It's weird. It's really weird.
I love that. I mean, I'm a straight edge guy, but I've, with my friends, done the like Dark Side of the Moon, Pink Floyd thing, completely stone cold sober. It still works. It's so fun.
Absolutely.
So I'm definitely going to try that with yours. It's
fun. Now, Adam, you've done it with Dub Side of the Moon.
I haven't. I got to try that too. Yeah. Maybe I got to make like a whole week of it.
So we got, yeah. I think it's interesting that like Dark Side of the Moon is like this legendary, you know, album, sacred, whatever, but Dub Side of the Moon is awesome. Like I remember when I heard about Dub Side of the Moon when it came out, I was like, it sounded like too gimmicky to me. But you know, then it turns out that it's all like legit, real like reggae musicians.
Great album.
And they're, you know, they're not approaching it like a gimmick per se. They're approaching it like, you know, reggae, they, you know, it's not uncommon. It's part of reggae culture to create reggae versions of existing songs. So it's really not a stretch whatsoever. So it actually sounds really cool. And then your record, listening to your record, it's like, it sounds cool too, because I don't know. It's like, it is like this idea that like of covering like sacred material, like a lot of times with sacred material is actually really good fodder because it's so familiar to people to just hear different interpretations of it.
Yeah. Our live show went off too, man. Like it was, like I said earlier, like I never get nervous or stage fright or anything like that. That's true when it comes to my own bands. The only time I ever get nervous is when I'm about to take the stage and do the whole Pink Floyd show, because it's not my music. You know, it was a real different feeling than I thought. And then like, by the time we get to Wish You Were Here, which we do like a crazy metal version of it, it's fucking awesome. It sounds like Foo Fighters or something. It's like, it hits people hard. You can tell, man, those songs run deep in our culture and in our DNA at this point.
Yeah.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
So one of the things that I find to be very different between ska and metal, and we kind of touched on this a little bit, within ska, it's like everything's ska, you know, like Blue Meanies, ska, right? And maybe we might get into a conversation of distinguishing between ska, core, traditional ska. I mean, there's like four or five labels we can throw on, right?
Sure.
Metal. Now we get into the nitty gritty of distinguishing the subgenres of metal. Like there are hundreds of metal subgenres.
Oh, at least. Yeah, I made a meme like a long time ago that was Forrest Gump and Bubba like on the floor, cleaning the floor of the barracks with toothbrushes, and Bubba's going, there's power metal, and thrash metal, and speed metal, death metal. Yeah, I just went on and on with it. It was fun.
I went to a website and I printed out a list of some metal subgenres. So let's read some of them. And if you have any comments on any of these, please just pipe in. Okay, heavy metal, speed metal, thrash metal, power metal. Okay, now we have death metal, but there's
all basic metals here. Yeah.
So we have three subgenres of death metal.
Okay.
We have melodic death metal.
Yes, my favorite.
Technical death metal and brutal death metal.
Uh huh. Okay. Yep. That checks out.
You fine with that? Okay. Next we have slam death metal.
Whoa. Okay.
Yeah. Any idea what that is?
Yeah, it's more like I would think that it would be like the more like electronic forward, but then technically, see, this is where we're talking about the difference between stoner and not stoner or whatever. Your death metal band, your lyrics have to be about death or, you know, the putrefaction, some sort of thing about things being dead. So that's the kind of underlying current there.
Okay. Now we have black metal, but there's, let's see, six subgenres of black metal.
Lord.
Let's go through them. First wave of black metal, or otherwise known as blackened thrash metal.
Yep.
True Norwegian black metal.
Okay.
Depressive suicidal black metal.
God.
Symphonic black metal.
Depressive suicidal black metal. You know, the people that, well, I learned this from somebody, that the people that kill themselves aren't the people that talk about it all the time. You know what I mean? If you're going to do it, you usually just do it, you know? So singing about whatever. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
We got post black metal. I'm very curious what post black metal is.
Huh? Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, we'll have to look that one up. And then atmospheric black metal.
Yeah. Okay. I get behind that. Well, you know, there's
I mean, isn't all... black metal already sort of atmospheric to begin with?
No. Technically, it just depends on the kind. I mean, black metal is supposed to be, you know, really lo-fi, unmastered, if you can get it that way, you know, just very bare bones. Black metal has to, it's like the lyrical content is not as, you know, death centric or whatever like that. But you can think about a band, you know, like a Blood Incantation. They're more of like the technical death metal kind of thing, but they also kind of tread the line of that atmospheric black metal where some of their, like their latest record was completely ambient, you know, from the same band, you know? So like it's interesting the way that they're sort of trying to just commandeer so like so many genres that they just become Blood Incantation as their own thing. Like they are their own genre. You know what I mean? And I like bands like that, kind of how Queen is just Queen. They can play anything they want. You know, so I typically gravitate toward more bands that straddle genres rather than like commit to one fully. But then you got a band like Carcass, you know, who have been just pure melodic death metal like for this whole time, you know, and just evolving in that one genre. So I don't know. It's just, God, metal's so dumb. I swear to God.
Let's get it. Speaking of, let's get into the next two.
Okay.
Pagan metal and Viking metal.
I always thought that we were like a pagan metal band. You know, we sing a lot about pagan stuff. And it's you know, like the Maiden, Mother and Crone, the Three Witches. We made up a lot of our own lore. I mean, that was all JD, his vision and stuff like that. But it's still, I always kind of thought that we were more in that.
What would you say is the difference between pagan metal and Viking metal?
Well, you know, Viking metal, I would say that, you know, you got your Amon Amarth, you know, it's very, Viking metal is like real theatrical in a sense where like, you know, you probably will have swords or battle axes or armor on the stage or something like that. You know, pagan metal would be more ritual oriented, I would suppose, you know, like you got a band like Watain, which is like, you know, really brutal death metal. But they're very ritualistic in the way that they present themselves. I think it's disgusting, but you know, that's just to each their own. You know what I mean?
Folk metal.
Yeah, I like me some folk metal.
What does folk metal sound like? Is it literally folk instrumentation?
I guess you could think about it that way. That'd be cool. I think about it more like, have you ever heard of a band called Hammers of Misfortune? Ulver, you could say, is another great folk metal band. They're pretty minimal, but we're splitting hairs here at this point.
That seems to be the whole case, though, right?
Yeah.
Symphonic metal, I get that one.
Easy.
Gothic metal, glam metal, yeah. Is glam metal, is that totally out of fashion at this point?
No, not if you do it right.
What about hair metal? I mean, in terms of new bands and new audience.
Oh, there's got to be new hair metal bands.
I mean, Steel Panther is just destroying it lately.
Oh, yeah. That's like
that's kind of a shtick.
Satirical.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I would way rather take that over somebody than a real glam band that's taking themselves seriously.
Sure.
If you want to like go that far, then you got bands like, what are they called, Murder Dolls or whatever, where it's like you almost kind of have to be from Hollywood and you have to be like that LA fucking ding dong that thinks doing that kind of shit's cool, you know? I don't know, like I'm to each their own, man, but like if the more like time you spend on like your clothes and like the bracelets you're wearing and like the little dangly, it's just like, what are you even fucking doing? Play guitar.
Yeah, for real.
Had a good song. Or if your songs are good, you have to have really fucking good songs if you spend that much time on everything else.
Absolutely.
Under doom metal, we got funeral doom metal and stoner doom metal.
Okay, yeah, I'll take that. Yeah,
I've never heard of funeral doom metal.
So funeral doom, I guess, would be like your more traditional, like what doom just used to be all around, like Burning Wind.
Oh, okay.
I still, that album Crippled Lucifer is still, I think, like the pinnacle of what doom is.
We got groove metal, okay, industrial metal, modern metal. I don't know what I mean by that.
Modern metal. I like that. They're calling it, like, these days they're sort of calling it the new wave of American heavy metal, which is bands like Lamb of God, just modern metal, like, you know, God Forbid. Typically what we'd normally call like butt rock, you know, I guess, you know, like your Nickelbacks and things like that. You know, like they're not really new metal. They're not, you know, pop, you know. Yeah.
What's your, let's take a side tangent. What's your take on Nickelback?
I've heard a lot of stories about Chad from, you know, like direct stories about just what an awful person he is. But I, time and a place, you know, if you're like in a strip club and they're like blasting Nickelback, you're like, oh, you know what, this ain't that bad, you know. But if I'm like, you know, eating, like making a sandwich in my house, I just turn that shit off, you know what I mean? I know of one story that did happen. It was when Chad is his name, the singer, he was married to Avril Lavigne for a while, and then so she, like, Live Nation bought one of her tours. And I might get some of these numbers a little bit wrong, but this is, they're not that far off. Like, I swear it was like they wanted to give her like $20 million for her whole tour. And there was a stipulation in her contract that said, like, if she got sick or whatever, like this one specific little clause, then she would get to keep the money and then not have to play the shows. And so she magically got laryngitis, canceled the whole tour, and kept the $20 million. And I just know that, like, he had something to do with that. I just feel it in my bones, you know. So I don't know. I feel like the guy's a fucking weasel, and they're not married anymore. So yeah, maybe that, you know, tells you something about that. Nickelback, whatever. All
right, let's kind of skim a few more of these. Pirate metal.
Yeah,
that's not a thing. Come on.
Yeah, it is.
Is that a thing?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
It's a thing, Adam.
Oh my god.
I mean, there's only like one band. But yeah, that's the thing.
One band making the whole genre.
Is that one of the things, the beauty of metal, is that you can just invent a style?
Sure.
And have it apply to your band exclusively?
Yeah, fuck it.
Yeah. math metal, yeah, okay. Grindcore, we got, okay, gore grind.
Uh-huh.
Death grind. Power violence, and then there's one that's called
my favorite, power
violence. Porn grind / shit grind.
Yeah,
shit grind. Yeah, I wow, I can't believe that's a real thing. I made that up like 15 years ago. I made a fake band called Shitty Butt that we recorded. I recorded it all by myself, but I wrote a whole like band history. There was a while where I wanted to start a record label that only put out fake bands, but like as reissues. You know what I mean? So like, and then you would write in the liner notes, like write the whole band history and everything. And it's just, oh, this is like way before Hard Times started doing bullshit like that and everything. I clearly didn't take it too far, but yeah, Shitty Butt. So shit grind is a real thing now, huh? All right. Wow.
The Shitty Butt is your fake band?
Uh-huh. Shittibutt.
So no music?
It's on my Patreon. If you like go way, way deep down there, you can read the whole story and listen to the shitty fucking demo I made. Actually, one of the songs on there ended up, I redid it as the theme song for my podcast. So, you know, it wasn't, every time I try to make a joke, I end up taking it too seriously. And like, I was like, well, I can't make something suck on purpose, you know? And so it ended up being a lot of fun. But
I mean, yeah, a joke's way better if it's done well.
I know. It was fun. Yeah, Shitty Butt. Our album was called Cream of the Crap.
Great name.
What was your musical inspiration for these demos?
I used to be in a band called Bloody Murder Weapon. And that was kind of like when I first moved to Austin, I was like, I need to make a grindcore EP now. You know, like I need something to to put on these tables next to all this other shit. And then, like, you know, I'll make a name for myself somehow, you know, and wrote and recorded, I think, 7 songs in 4 minutes of an EP, and then kind of handed that out. And because of that, that made the rounds, and I ended up in a band called Kids in Service to Satan. And then when that band fizzled out, and that band that I was telling you about, Employer Employee, when they broke up, they had already sort of known about my other bands, and then they brought me in and we started a band together. And so, yeah, it all kind of happened real fast, but that was all just kind of coming from the grind scene of like bands like Spaz or the Circle of Dead Children, Converge, you know, Botch, just bands like that were just I had a lot of noise to make, and I was really I was an angry kid, and so that was kind of where that idea came from. But then once I was wanting to do Shitty Butt, you know, I don't even remember like where that fucking idea came from. I was just like, oh, this band sucks, they sound like a shitty butt, and yeah, it was just, I think that it's something like that. That's kind of how it started somewhere down the line.
You did a few songs, I think it was 2020, for the project Dirty Restaurant of Death.
Yeah, that was me and my daughter's little project that we did. She was 3 at the time, and yeah, the pandemic was full swing. And she was my friend. Her mother decided to up and leave me, and they have they all live in Phoenix right now. Unfortunately, I miss my kids every day. I get to see them as often as I can, and I'm getting there for Christmas, yay! But yeah, me and her would sit around and just be idiots and write songs. And we wrote this one song called Dinosaur, and I was like, wow, this is actually like really catchy. And then so I recorded it, and then we did it, and I was like, all right, we got a band, baby. And I was like, it's got to be Kyle Shutt and like the band, you know, or whatever. So I was like, what do you want your band to be called? And she goes, Dirty Restaurant of Death. I was like, whoa, like what? She's like, Dirty Restaurant of Death, get out of here. And I was like, what the fuck? And like, from what I could put together, I was like, one of our daddy daughter things that we used to love to do was to go to this pizza place in Austin called Home Slice, and we would, you know, I would get a couple beers and some pizza, she would get pizza, run around and play, and we had a great time. I miss her. But having to explain to her why we couldn't do that anymore during the early days of the pandemic, you know, I was just like, sorry baby, this is like, you know, the restaurants are real, they're dirty places where like lots of germs have the potential to be. So we can't go there right now, 'cause like, you know, a lot of people are dying out in the world and we're trying to make sure. So in her head, she was just like, Dirty Restaurant of Death.
Oh, wow.
And so I let her have it. That was her choice for the band title. So yeah, that was, and then I ended up pressing it to a 7-inch. Hey, you can buy on my Bandcamp page.
Yeah, the second song is called Poop.
Yeah, and I was like, well, we got to write a 7-inch, babe. What's the B-side going to be? Like, what do you want to write about? And she goes, poop. I was like, no, I'm not going to write a song about poop. No, we pick anything else you want. What do you want to write about? And she's like, poop. And so she wouldn't fucking let it go. Her artistic vision would not be compromised. And so I wrote a song about how I want to write a song about anything else, but all she ever wants to sing about is poop. And that's how that song came to be.
Yeah.
Incredible.
The cover. So tell me about the cover.
It was just a guy named Drizza, a tattooer from, I believe he's from Tampa, maybe St. Pete. What's up, Driz? I just let him run wild. I have a saying, let the artist art. And I like to tell an artist, like, hey, I've got this song about dinosaurs and there's also some poop in there, but it's like with my kids, so it would be cool if it was like, you know, tongue-in-cheek and lighthearted, you know. And he drew a dinosaur taking a massive shit, there it is. You can't unsee it.
So when you showed the cover to your daughter, what did she say?
Oh, she lost her mind. I did it up as a black and white thing too, so like the inserts of the 7-inch are like a coloring book, you know, so you could color your own thing. So, and I signed a bunch of them, and she colored them, and that was sort of like the deluxe pre-order edition that you could get.
It's a little shift here. I was reading in our interview, and you were talking about how the Sword were one of the first bands to do alcohol beverage branding.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just fascinated. I don't really know much about this topic, but I'm just curious about it.
Oh, I mean,
what did you do? And
yeah, we were by no means the first band to ever have their own beer, but I mean, like, we were of all like the popular metal bands at the time. We were really at the forefront of doing a lot of atypical merch items, and that was one of the ways that we really stood out. I've always been a kind of a fixture in the Austin beer scene, just because I'm an alcoholic, but also you know, when I first moved to Austin, there was three places that brewed their own beer. There was the B-Side downtown, which burned down, and then there was the Draft House. And then there was Lovejoy's downtown, which you couldn't taste the beer because you could smoke inside. So I don't know, people would be like, is there beer any good? I'd be like, I don't know, it just tastes like cigarettes. The Draft House was a great beer bar before Austin became like fucking beer town. And I hung out there every day for like 10 years. You could meet, you know, bookies, lawyers, drug dealers, doctors, like whatever. It was just everybody hung out there. And I got to know so many fucking people all over. And because of that, like, it was a really well-known like beer destination for people traveling in from other places. And it was, you know, they had like 85 taps, where everywhere else in town had like five taps, and they were all Miller Lite. I'm not really as into beer as much now as I was then. But at one point I was like really, really into fucking beer. Before it was craft beer, it was just beer, you know? I ended up becoming really good friends with a guy named Eric Ogershock, who was the head brewer for Real Ale Brewing Company out here. And they were kind of out in the hill country, but they still kind of claim Austin as home. And we just talked about, we should do a collaboration. We should, you know, make a beer, and then we'll have a release show for it, and this and that, because you're always having like beer festivals, and you do collaborate with like a cheese company or some shit. I don't know, you know, like, why not do a fucking metal band? And they convinced their company, which was, you know, a high volume brewery. I mean, like, I think they ran like 3,000 cases of that shit, the first run, and we sold it. I mean, it was, they had, you know, giant displays of it in every grocery store in Austin, and it was, I mean, it was a real thing, you know, like the first run of Sword beer.
So was it just called Sword beer?
No, it was called Iron Swan, after a song off of our first record. Uh-huh. And it was, we made it after one of my favorite beers in the UK called Spitfire, that you just can't get in the States, and so it was my attempt at making a hoppy ESB. It went off, but then like the next, like that summer, all of a sudden, you know, Iron Maiden's got their beer that they're rolling out now, and like, you know, Motorhead's got one, and it's, but they didn't even make it, they just went to Cooper's and like got their fucking, you know, label slapped on a can. And I was like, that's not even, you're just like branding yourself, you know. But then to take that a step further, like we started doing things like where if we used an artist on this record that looked like this, the next thing you know, Mastodon's doing the same thing, you know, with like that. So you could tell that like way bigger bands than us had their eyes on us and would just steal our ideas because they didn't, their ideas weren't as cool. And I say that with no ego at all. I'm just the fucking truth. Like seriously, with Shadow, the bike company, we did a Sword branded BMX bike. It was fucking sick. Fucking 3 months later, Slayer's got one. You know, that's not a coincidence. So yeah, I do take a lot of pride in, because I had a heavy hand in a lot of that marketing and merchandise manufacturing for the band during that time.
Yeah, I think like the idea, especially when you're not like the big band in the scene, the idea of doing collaborations with company like involves a lot of elbow grease and a lot of creativity. And I like the idea of like if you're involved with the actual creative process, not just slapping your name on it, like you're talking about. Whereas like when you're a bigger band, when you're a huge celebrity that like suddenly wants to own a jewelry line or a makeup line, you know that they're not like down there, like trying to come up with the perfect whatever. Mm-hmm. They're not involved. They're just putting their name on it.
Yeah.
And to me, that just seems dumb.
Yep.
Like if you're gonna put your name on something, you should be involved with the creative process of creating it.
Mm-hmm. That's why, like, you know, like Les Claypool with Primus, you know, he's got his own Purple Pachyderm, winery, you know, and they make actually very good wine. But he's down there, like, you know, putting his hands in the dirt.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be right back after this.
So other than, like, you said that creative approach to merch. So aside from these sort of collaborations, what are some of your creative approaches to merch that you've had over the years?
I've got a bunch in my back pocket that I haven't rolled out yet that I'm really excited about. But over the years, you know, one of the first ones we ever did, and I did steal this idea from Murder City Devils. But, you know, when you go to the store, like a 7-Eleven, and you buy a beer and they put it in a paper bag.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like I went to a Murder City Devils at the drive-in show, and Murder City had like those beer bags, but with their stamp on them, like their logo stamped on it. And I was like, that's fucking genius. So like a couple years later, when the Sword was going pretty strong, and then we were going to play at Emo's during South by Southwest. I was like, fuck giving out CDs, fuck giving out this. I was like, I'm just going to go buy a bunch of beer bags and make, I worked at a photocopy kind of print center. So I made a rubber stamp with our logo on it, and I just stamped like 1,000 beer bags, and I just left them all over the venue, like at every bar. And it became a thing where I realized that, like, I was like, man, nobody's like using them. Everyone just like stuck them in their back pocket. And I was like, oh, God damn it. Like the point was that everybody's supposed to have their beers in them. So I think I made more like the second show that we did, and I just put those out. And so like enough for everybody to like have two, you know, and then yeah, eventually it caught on. And I think like Chuck Klosterman like wrote about it in Spin. I think that, yeah, I mean, it worked. We got some press out of it for sure. For such like a cheap, you know, free thing for fans to have. People love free shit.
Yeah.
What else did we do? But, you know, we had one, it was a, what would you call it? Like a phantom merch item that we used to have this tour manager named Ben Adams. What's up, Ben? And he was in, he kind of came from the Chicago kind of ska punk scene. I'm not going to name his band because he would murder me if I did. But
but you should, though.
I should. It was called Manic Sewing Circle. Sorry, Ben. Yeah. They weren't bad. They weren't bad. But
hey, that's a cool name.
Yeah. It was, honestly, it was not a bad band either.
It evokes an interesting image.
But he was asleep all the time. We used to call him Sleeping Ass Ben. And I was like, what's up, sleeping ass? And we had our graphic design team like behind the scenes create what we called the Sleeping Ass Ben package. And it was like a sword snuggie and pillowcase and like eye cover, you know, whatever, iPad. Anything jokey and dumb you could imagine, like little pajama socks or whatever. We just had it mocked up in an image. You know what I mean? And it looked real. It looked like something you could fucking pre-order right now. And then we're like, so what we'll do is we'll accidentally have him copied on an email where we're sending it around. So it seems like we're trying to do it behind his back and we're about to roll it out, you know? And then so we did it. So then we like sent the email and we're kind of just sitting in the dressing room, and he just busts in the door. He goes, dudes, what the fuck is this? Oh my God, are you fucking serious? Is this a real thing? Oh my God, dude, we have to get this. Blah, 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 blah. And it kind of backfired because he thought it was funny. We just wanted to get on his nerves. But so then we were like, well, let's just post it on Facebook with no caption. Let's just post this picture, you know? And dude, it got like 500,000 views in the first hour or something, you know? And people were straight up like, where do I buy this, you know? So then we're like, shit, man, I mean, God, are we really gonna make this? Is this like a thing, you know? It just kind of was a joke that it quickly got out of hand. And then people at the merch table every day on that tour just come up, I want the snuggie, where's the snuggie? And then so we're like, all right, I guess we're making snuggies, you know? And so we looked into it, And the minimum order for Snuggies back in those days was 5,000.
Oh my God.
And I was like, I'm not ordering 5,000 Snuggies. No. I mean, I know you're all saying that you want it, but the second that I actually make it, you're not going to buy it. You just, you want it because you can't have it. And right. so we never pulled the trigger. I think for the better, but yeah, that was the early days of, clever marketing for us. I don't know. There was so much. We did so many beers over the years. We did these amazing beer steins, like real deal German official like beer steins. Skateboards. I mean, you know, all the typical merch that other bands do. But yeah, that was yeah. That was a wild ride. I truly enjoy marketing and merchandising things like
that. Was there any merch item that was awful to tour with? Like beer signs, if you tried to take those, and I feel like
we never took those on the road.
Yeah,
that our fulfillment center at Indie Merch, they would handle all the that kind of stuff. We were smart about what we took on the road and things like that, and we didn't want, you know, because like trucker hats are cool, but the boxes are huge, you know, and like you can only fit like 100 of them in that big box, whereas you know there's other things that come in smaller boxes that you can sell for the same price and then just not have your trailer like completely full of merch, which I was guilty of keeping our trailer entirely full of merch at all times. Yeah, I like making money, man.
Yeah, I mean, it's better than being out of stuff.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I remember when I saw the toasters like 6 or 7 years ago, hadn't seen them in a while, and they had their own line of hot sauce on the merch booth.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, that's cool. And I asked Bucket, I was like, what's up with the hot sauce? He's like, oh, nobody's buying CDs. So, you know, we sell more hot sauce than albums.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, oh, that makes sense. Yeah. I guess, you know, maybe they love the band, but they don't really want to own CDs. But they'll see the hot sauce and they'll be like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, totally.
I got to have that.
Yeah. We weren't the first band to ever have a hot sauce, but we definitely like made it popular in the metal scene just because like it was kind of an accident. Like we just did it as kind of a joke because we had a song called Tears of Fire, and our record label guy at the time, Jeff K, he was like, what if we did a hot sauce called Tears of Fire and it's really hot? And like, but we didn't want to just slap a label on something. So we found a guy in Austin and like made a, you know, really nice, delicious hot sauce, which just he just retired and retired the recipe around the same time that the Sword decided to, well, one of us decided to hang up the hat. And that's where the hot sauce idea came from. But we ended up on the Travel Channel, like on No Reservations with Anthony Bourdain, eating oysters with our hot sauce. And so we basically just got like a free commercial for our fucking hot sauce on the Travel Channel. And online sales for that just went through the roof. It was awesome. It was, I can't believe like we had a hot sauce in production for like over a decade.
What was it like? What was it like hanging out with Anthony Bourdain?
He was awesome. He was a very, very kind man. You get the impression that he talks a lot just because he narrates his own show, I guess, you know, but he actually, he really listened to what you had to say, and he cared about what you had to say. And, the world needs more people like him, not less.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like Anthony a lot. And, I think there's a certain layer where he carried himself where it was like, I'm the badass chef who travels the world. But just under that layer was like, I think the guy who was very curious about the world. And I remember watching this one episode in like, I can't remember, somewhere like a Latin country, kind of in the Caribbean area. Maybe it was Puerto Rico or maybe it was something different, but he was like hanging out with these people in there. And then one of them was like, you're actually like, I just thought you were going to be super arrogant and come in here and just tell us all this stuff about, you know, like a know-it-all. And he's like, I don't know anything, you know, I just assume you guys know, and I want to hear what you have to say. And I was like, yeah, I appreciate that attitude.
Yeah.
I think that if you watch his shows, you can see that's actually how he approached it.
He was a very, very genuine person. Like he, know, he was reached out to us because he wasn't like a fan of the band necessarily, but he knew that like of all the bands that he could talk to in town, that we were like definitely the contenders. And then, you know, listening to the places that we wanted to go, I took him to the Draft House to have some beers, took him to eat some oysters afterwards at our favorite little fish market. He wanted to hang out like where bands hang out. You know, he didn't want to go to like some fucking fancy plants place or whatever like that. And then the next night we were actually playing the very last show at Emo's ever, the old one. And it was Fiddlar, back when they were first starting out, Cage the Elephant, The Sword, Jimmy Cliff. And he came out to the show and it was fucking awesome. Sweet guy. Real sweet guy.
Nice. In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
I think you were our first metal musician to be on In Defense of Ska. Am I right, Adam?
I think so.
Yeah. So a lot of people from the punk scene, you know, I think it's becoming more and more evident to me. I think I was already aware of this, but it was more and more evident that like through the years, the punk, emo, hardcore, and ska scenes have overlapped pretty significantly.
Yeah.
But I always feel like metal's a little bit on its own scene and doesn't cross-pollinate with those scenes quite as much. What's your take on that?
That's a really good question or statement, I suppose. That's so like y'all remember the 90s, like everything was like super elitist. It was like not cool to like things, you know, and I think that did a whole generation of music fans a disservice. Because now it's everyone likes everything, but metal, yeah, it was kind of like vilified for a long time, and rightfully so. A lot of the people that listened to, you know, the mainstream metal in the late 90s were a bunch of, you know, troglodytes, you know, just cave people. And you know, it was a very aggressive, not very inclusive kind of music for a very specific kind of misfit that just wanted to go beat the shit out of other people, like-minded people in the pit. And like, it wasn't communal at all from an outsider's point of view. And I think over the years it's gotten more friendly and stuff like that, but also like the, you know, like you said, there's only five or six kinds of ska or whatever. Yeah, there's like three kinds of emo. You know, there's 500 kinds of metal. And so like within that realm, you know, it's sort of like for more people that came into that fold, there became more subgenres of them there for them to sort of gravitate toward and things like that. Now you have festivals like, you know, Psycho Las Vegas that has, you know, bands like Rotting Christ and Carcass, but they also have, you know, Dwarves and Bone Thugs and Harmony. And it's slowly starting to kind of like creep out and just not be about a bunch of fat white dudes with beards anymore. You know, it's a lot more inclusive than it used to be, but it's taken a lot longer than like anything from the punk or hardcore or emo ska scenes like that.
Yeah, I was going to say, and you kind of already intimated this, but I was going to say metal sort of being a little bit on its own island. Maybe that's why it created so many subgenres, because rather than coexisting with other styles of music, it's created other styles of music within itself.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's interesting. Where do you feel like, do you feel like looking on the metal landscape, do you feel like, does some of the metal scene feel like it doesn't even feel like your scene at all? Is it that disparate, like all these different subgenres, or is it just like we're all metal?
I don't know. I'm a punk at heart, honestly. Like if I'm putting music on these days, it's gonna be the Nerves or No Means No, Who's Could Do, things like that, you know. I love Prince, Madonna, The Cure. I really haven't listened. I mean, when The Sword first started out, you know, we were all really into, you know, like, you know, bands like Metallica, Slayer, Sabbath, things like that. But just over the years, you know, just like being on tour all the time, constantly having like that kind of music shoved down your throat and stuff, like it's just, it can get kind of eye rolling after a while.
Yeah.
Especially when people take it really seriously. I'm usually not a fan of people that take themselves too seriously. So, you know, it's something that I guess I've always struggled with is whenever I put out some like solo output, a lot of my fan base wants to be like Sword Part 2 or something like that. And it's just not who I am, you know, mm-hmm. like it's not. If I did it, it's going to be because it's because I want to do it. I'm not just going to like sit there and make an album just to please a bunch of people, even though it might, you know, make me some money. I do really enjoy making money, but also it's never the point of it all. You know, I really enjoy creating art that is true to myself and that will eventually find its, you know, its people. That's why I've been painting a lot lately. I don't know if you've seen any of my silly self-portrait sort of things that I do, but yeah, it's painting and podcasting is stuff that like I never ever thought I would do. I've always considered myself a guitar player, but the older I get, then the harder it is to be a musician these days for a living. You know, it's I don't know. I've found myself branching out into other sort of art forms, and so it's I don't know. It's weird. So yeah, within Is it metal to paint yourself as Cruella de Vil? I don't know. You know, maybe it's metal as fuck. You know, I just don't even care anymore. It's, you know, I'm just me. And, you know, people seem to get that at this point. Maybe 5 years ago, it was a little bit harder of a sell. But, you know, I think people know at this point.
So since this is your first podcast since the band broke up, you don't have to say anything, or if you want to say anything about the breakup, you're welcome to before we end.
No, you know, I'm going to make a statement on my own show about it. I'm sure people are waiting. It was a pretty devastating situation for me personally. It's half my life basically behind me now. As like I said, I'm 40 now. I started the band when I was 20 with JD, and I don't know yet, man. I'm because, you know, but the nature of my show is I try to be as jovial as possible while also kind of talking some light shit on some other things. And so perhaps I'll have an episode soon. You know, I had a few interviews already like in the can that I just, I don't know, like that I felt like weren't really up to snuff. And then it just the show itself kind of got bogged down, and I was trying to write some new Sword material for a new record, and that's just where a lot of my focus was, you know. And now that bandwidth is completely freed up in my brain, that it's going to take me a little time to focus and figure out what to invest my energy fully in, you know. So I didn't want to just like put out a bunch of shitty interviews or podcasts or whatever just to have content out there. I really wanted to take a step back and just allow myself to breathe. And then I also like have bills to pay, so I had to get like 3 jobs. But that's just what I say, like, because my friend Mike Wiebe from Riverboat Gamblers, he always says, I play music for a living, so that means I am a bartender. That's what I do now.
Yeah, I mean, it takes, when these sort of things happen, it takes time to process. I think people expect statements immediately, but it takes time to process how you feel about it and all that.
Yeah, we already went through the hiatus, you know, thing like a few years ago, and like coming off the heels of that, I really felt like we were back, you know, and it felt really great. So this is a really unexpected blow, and I have no fucking plans like anytime soon to do anything. Yeah, I just need, because before it was like I just hit the ground running with my solo album and with Doomside of the Moon and all this other shit, and this now it's like I need to really regroup.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
That's why I want to talk about you know, I will leave you with this thing though, just to kind of tie up the whole Blue Meanies saga, because they were a very important band to me. Like I said, going down the path of like podcasting or like painting or doing other art forms that I'm not necessarily known for, a good friend of mine, JT Habersat, who is a fantastic comic in town, he puts together these groups of musicians, and he calls it Road Stories Live, where we would all get together. And it really kind of like inspired me to take the direction that I took on my podcast. So it'd be a bunch of us just dudes in bands, not doing stand-up comedy or anything like that, just getting up there and telling funny road stories. And it really kind of like, he basically like pushed me on stage and made me do it. And it turns out I'm like halfway decent at it. And so it became a thing that we started to do regularly. And then he wanted to take it on the road. And so he got a group of us. I think it was Dave from the Casualties. And then Mike Wiebe from Riverboat Gamblers, and me and our friend Dirty Charlie. We all got in a car and did a handful of dates. And we eventually played Hot Springs, Arkansas, which is where Bill from the Blue Meanies lives. And he had been friends with JT from his days in New York as a radio, like college radio DJ. And Bill ended up inviting us over for dinner and got to go to his house and have some delicious bratwurst and punish him with stories about how I used to be on the street team when I was 17. And he was the kindest man. He has a wonderful family and a beautiful home.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the difference between the Blue Meanies on stage and the Blue Meanies off stage.
I've only talked to Bill since I've been older, but even when I was younger, they were very, very kind to me. As a 17, 18 year old, whatever, you know, and I was at enough of their shows to where they would recognize me, you know, as one of the regulars. But I could also tell that they had very distinct personalities off stage, you know, and like I could tell, like, you know, Bill always sold the merch. He would go from the stage to the merch table and sell that shit all night long. And their, you know, trumpet player always seemed a little more snarky, you know, and their guitar players seemed just happy to be there. Sean, he follows me on Twitter now. He seems like he's a real sweet guy.
Yeah.
Chaz also, he seemed like he had a bit of an attitude. I don't know, in a good way. I don't mean that in a negative way, you know, but it was just, that was, you know, that's kind of like what a band like that sounds like, is when like this, however many, 6, 7, like very different personalities get together, you end up with music that sounds like that.
Thank you so much for listening to In Defense of Ska. If you've enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe to the podcast wherever you normally stream or download episodes. If you haven't already, grab a copy of my book, In Defense of Ska, available at clashbooks.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. It's at In Defense of Ska. And please consider joining our Patreon at patreon.com/indefenseofska. You will get monthly bonus episodes, extended interviews and commentary per episode, and access to the In Defense of Ska Discord. In Defense of Ska would not be possible without the great team that tirelessly works on it every week. So you should go check out their other projects as well. Co-host Adam Davis has an amazing band called Omnigon. Give them a follow on Instagram and Twitter. It's simply at Omnigon. And our editor, Chris Reeves, has a phenomenal record label and podcast called Ska Punk International. For more information, go to skapunkinternational.com. And if you've ever enjoyed one of the highly specific In Defense of Ska memes floating around the interwebs, it was likely the work of The Bands I Like Only Charge $18. Find them on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And on that note, we leave you by saying, Ska now more than ever.